We have to take roll call, so we're good since it's a board meeting for us. So we're just going to get started real quick. This is Marysville Board of Education, special meeting of Tuesday, July 31st, 2012. Can I roll call, please?
Mr. Mabee.
Here.
Mrs. Greer.
Here.
Mrs. Devine.
Here.
Mr. Lassiter.
Here.
Mrs. Powers.
Here.
Okay. Well, we'll get started. Kimball Carey, I don't know. Everybody knows Kimball?
I don't know.
You do now, right? You're going to. He's going to be talking about fiduciary duties for, well, I'll let you introduce what you're talking about.
Yeah, well, let me just pass this down. Yeah, well, thanks for having me. I take the topic to be like board member ethics and responsibilities, and we can talk about anything around that you want.
Actually, could I ask everybody just to kind of introduce themselves since it's kind of a nice deal to get people from different districts in here. So, sir, we'll start down to you.
Yeah, my name is Bill Davenport. I'm a member of the North Union School Board.
Great, awesome.
Scott Meehan, CFO, Treasurer of North Union Local School.
I'm Dr. Rick Smith, Superintendent of North Union.
Lisa Atkins, Board Member of Fairbanks.
Bob Humble, Superintendent Fairbanks.
Andy Culp, future Assistant Superintendent of Marysville Schools.
Ben Lassiter, Board Member of Marysville Schools.
Tracy Greer, School Board Member here at Marysville.
Sue Devine, Marysville School Board.
Jeff Mabee of Marysville School Board.
Amy Powers, Marysville School Board.
Right. Brian Bumgarner, North Union School Board.
Jane and Everett, Fairbanks School Board.
And we make him superintendent of Marysville. Okay.
Thank you. And I guess you know who I am.
Is that better or worse?
That's better.
Clear? No.
Yeah. You're like optometrist.
I'll go into that. That comes along a little bit later here, but thanks. You know, this is a topic that, you know, I don't know how to make this engaging for you. You probably all came with something when you think about board member issues you have in mind, and I hope you have a chance to talk about that. Whether it's your own responsibilities or liability or problem board member, there can't be any in the room, but what the public is really looking for these days. What I have here is just kind of some materials that I'm going to work through. And the thing that's on top is kind of an outline that I will use as a rough framework here. But again, I really hope you have a chance to ask about what part of this, because we started talking about ethics and ethics rules, and there's just lots of nuances to that, and so many different situations you could talk about. Please let's do that. I kind of wanted to start with this piece. I think Jeff kind of started this thought process, I think, which is of a fiduciary, of being a fiduciary, which is kind of a strange word, and you've probably heard it. Some of you may be a fiduciary if you've been made the executor of someone's will in your family. You would know a fiduciary if you were someone's guardian. It's a position of trust, caring for something, whether it's someone's money, a child, someone's property in terms of an estate. It's a position of special trust that has a very high duty of care. So I started out with the question, did you know you are a fiduciary? The word fiduciary doesn't get used a whole lot, honestly, that I see with school board member duties and But the idea is certainly there of responsibility and trust. And I did find this in the Ohio Ethics Commission opinion, it's from 1999, that talks about if you're a member of a public board of education, you have the same kind of relationship to your district that a private entity, a private fiduciary has. They're a trustee, they're an executor, they're a guardian. It's an analogous relationship. And sometimes in the ethics rulings, they'll talk about it in that way, in terms of level of trust expected of you with respect to the district. The district, you are in effect guardians of the district. And so anyway, there's the word, there's the meaning. Based on these statutory provisions, it's clear that a member of the board, school district board of education, is a person to whom power is entrusted for the benefit of citizens of the district and who has a relationship with the district based on trust and confidence. Accordingly, commission, this is the Ohio Ethics Commission, concludes that members of the school district board of education have a fiduciary relationship with the school district. There's a page there on the word fiduciary from Wikipedia. I know I have a sister who's a retired school librarian, and she would kill me if she knew I was copying anything from Wikipedia. She, you know, her whole thing was to get students to develop research skills and do their index cards. Don't tell her, but I don't know. You know, my comeback for her, she lives in New Orleans. Anyone who decides to live below sea level, you can't know. You don't really have much room to criticize. Anyway, it is some of the history of the world. But Jeff, again, I think had commented, I'd ask for, you know, what do you want to hear about in terms of talking today? And I think there was some question around these words that you may get if you've been on a charitable board, a nonprofit board, if you in business, in your business, you were on a board of directors, some kind of board, corporate board, profit, nonprofit. You may have had some training or discussion about your responsibilities, sort of like we're having now. Those discussions will often use some of these terms about the fiduciary relationship to the corporation, the duty of care and loyalty. Here's another Wikipedia summary. But kind of just a good general description of these terms. Honestly, again, I don't see this terminology used much in the school context, but the concepts are there in the sense of, I think, the responsibility that you have. The business judgment rules, kind of an interesting, there's a question about how does that apply to in the corporate kind of terminology? You have this fiduciary responsibility as director of the board. Okay? And a fiduciary responsibility is in law school they talk about it as being like the highest level of care you would exercise. The ordinary level of care being, you know, what you're expected to do when you come up to a red light and what you do, you know, walking down the street, you know, not negligent. When you're a fiduciary for a child or someone's estate, you're expected to exercise the highest level of care. And parts of that, there's some of this terminology about the duty of loyalty. That's the criteria there. You act in good faith. You act in the best interest of the corporation. You act on an informed basis. You take your actions based upon being informed. That's a duty that you have. Not to be wasteful. That's more a corporate idea. And that your actions will not involve self-interest. That those kind of terms and language you will hear if you have the discussion as a board of directors and corporate setting. And where the business judgment rule comes in is sort of, you know, you kind of have to be careful when you start saying we have this really high level of care. We certainly, that's what we want people to exercise, but does that mean that you're, you know, if you fall from that, if you do less than that, there's liability. And in the corporate world, they have this concept called the business judgment rule, which is that, you're presumed to be acting, you know, in the interest of the corporation and the business unless someone can prove otherwise. And if you make a business judgment that this doesn't have a positive result, you're not automatically liable for it. If you're acting in good faith and you're informed and not self-dealing. Really, when you look at the public sector version of that, we have that with school. You probably know that from your board member training or your school on training. And what it is immunity. You know, on the public sector, the business of the things you do for school boards is that anyone working in public like that does is so important. We have to give some protection in terms of immunity for those things, or everything would grind to a halt. They sue you for everything they didn't like and everything. So I think it's very comparable, I guess, is what I'm coming to. In terms of the business judgment rule that you have immunity.
So when is that immunity? When do you lose your immunity, then, I guess, in the public sector? What would trigger your loss of immunity?
Really, it's two ideas with that. It's acting in good faith, which is also very like a corporate, and within the scope of your employment. Those are the two things that give you immunity under the case law in Ohio. And there's a statute here, too. And I thought I had it in here. I was going to show you. Let me see if it's here. It's 2744.
Yeah, it was right behind the business judgment rule in my packet.
Was it? Okay, was it stapled onto it?
Mine is loose.
Okay. Well, there it is. Okay, thank you. Where I wanted to go with this is that like the business judgment, or like in the corporate world, you're allowed to make a business judgment. In your world, you're allowed to make a business judgment in the business of education and all the things that you do. And the way that's kind of articulated in the law, public sector law, is in terms of immunity. There's good faith immunity for what all public employees do. And the two key elements of that are acting in good faith and not manifestly outside the scope. The courts developed that first, and then when this chapter 2744 came along, we call that the sovereign immunity law, it was put into law. And here's the section of law that protects you and says that your board, you're the corporate board, the district, has the duty to defend you if the act or omission occurs while you are acting both in good faith and your actions are not manifestly outside the scope of your employment. So if your intentions are good and what you're doing is somehow related to your work, you know, even if you're mistaken about that, and even if you make a mistake, and even if people are hurt by that, you are not liable. That's what immunity means. And the only thing that takes you to the point of being personally liable is when you're not acting in good faith. You're trying to hurt somebody or something. If that's the intention, and it's, you know, you're doing something that is not part in any way, shape, or form connected to employment. What the law does is say the board must defend you, so that means lining a legal defense, and then indemnify if there is a claim of a judgment against you. So in terms of the consequences of not, you know, following this high standard, I always want to emphasize that, because, you know, what you do is hard enough. You would just be frozen stiff if you really felt that it was liability, was a possibility. Good faith is really key. And when you see issues arise, it's always going to be people not acting in good faith, trying to do things in their job and get things that cause things to happen that they aren't part of the mission of the schools at all. Alright, so we have this pretty high standard, and what form does that, you know, what more can you tell me about that? Well, one thing that are developed, of course, are these codes of ethics. Ohio School Boards is probably the best known, and I pulled out this, I copied this, this is the Marysville board policy for the code of ethics, and these try to kind of define what that means in the school setting to act like a fiduciary. And you've probably seen this kind of thing. It's unethical for a board member to seek special privileges for personal gain, to personally assume unauthorized authority, to criticize school employees publicly, to disclose confidential information, place the interest of one group of the community over another. It's unethical for a board to withhold facts from the superintendent. This is getting in the board superintendent ethics, particularly about the incompetency of an employee, to consider a complaint against an employee, complaints which are not first submitted to the superintendent, announce future action if the proposition has been discussed by the board. Many other elements there laid down. That I've also copied, and I know that's an OSBA policy, and I give you that, not because it's Marysville, but that's going to be what many of you have. I copied another one, kind of randomly. It's Benton County. It had the look to me of a NOLA product, if some of you are nodding, you know what it looked like. Just in case some of you may use the NOLA, you might have something that reads more like this, although, you know, it picks up many of the same ideas.
Can you explain what disclosing of confidential information? You know, when you go into executive session, they're not necessarily confidential, but there's a perception that, you know, what you're talking about, especially if it's a business employer, those type of things could be. What's the determination that makes it confidential? Is it only FERPA or HEPA or one of the laws? What determines confidential information?
Yeah, that's a really good question and I think a real part of being a good board member and ethics is this question. It seems to come up a lot with executive sessions and how the board members handle those. To kind of start at the beginning just with executive sessions under the sunshine law, you know, what is the status? You know, you go in executive, what is that all, is that protected? Is it all confidential? Obviously, the law must think that there's some reason why it's okay for you to, you know, pull out of the public view. So there's certainly an intention in the law to allow the board to talk separately. But per se, what is said in executive session is not per se confidential in the sense that it's illegal to go out, walk out of the board meeting, say what you talked about. Now it is if you're talking about a student, you know, that would be a primary example. But let's say you're just talking about an individual employee. And what you're allowed to talk about in executive session, could a board member walk out and talk about it? Yeah. I mean, there's nothing in law that prevents that from happening.
Does it fall under ethics?
It falls under, yes. You're really in the realm of board member ethics, boardsmanship, whatever you want to call that. Now, I think that shocks a lot of people, and it's when board members do that, can really create some wedges in a board. And there are times when it almost becomes an unmanageable thing. Sometimes you have board members who are directly opposed to what the majority of the board is doing in a lawsuit or something like that. And we try to discuss that in executive session. You have a real problem, you know. You're on the other side of a lawsuit with somebody, and they're sitting in a board meeting, and if they don't excuse themselves, how does the board meeting? There is a way to address that I always want to talk about because it's such a problem when it happens. You never want to feel, because when you go on executive session, I think there's a real sense, a sense of trust with the others in there that you're not going to walk out. You know, it's, if you don't have that trust, then you lose the value of it, don't you? Because you can't express yourself. So, you hate it when that happens. But if you feel that a board member is going to do that, there's something in the ethics law, there's a provision in the ethics law that says that it's illegal for a public official to disclose publicly things that aren't confidential if they've been told that these things are confidential. And they are truly are confidential. Example would be, you know, talking with, I don't know, you're in there talking with board members about a tax abatement that Walmart wants, or somebody wants to come in. I mean, you're negotiating with someone. You might be negotiating with the city over some issue.
We're negotiating with the teachers.
Well, yeah, union, yeah. You know, I'm missing, right? The most obvious thing, and you're negotiating with people. And if a board member walks out and conveys that information, it's harmful to the board. That's kind of the definition of what the law recognizes as confidential, is if it is the disclosure will have an adverse impact on the district. So under this ethics law, if board members are told, and that's sort of the awkward part of this, the law says that if board members are advised that something is confidential and they disclose it, that's a violation of the ethics law. So at the back of the packet, we're kind of...
So that's the question about that.
I mean, there's sort of a form I've developed for that. Yeah.
So if someone, let's say we're talking, we're negotiating with Walmart about something.
Yeah.
And a board member walks out of executive session and goes and talks about it in public.
Yes.
Which would be detrimental to the district. Does that board member then lose his good faith immunity at that point? Would Walmart then be able to sue the district because a board member acted not in good faith for the district? Does that expose the district?
If the board member who did that,
he didn't agree. Let's just say he didn't agree with it. I mean, I'll make it a little easier.
Yeah. Well, it's like, what's good faith?
Well, if it's detrimental to the district, it's not a good faith.
If he just disagrees with it,
right?
I don't know that that's bad faith. I mean, I think if he disagrees with it because Walmart wants to build a store right next to his property and he thinks he's, sure. If he disagrees with it because he doesn't, he wants... somebody to lose their job. But I think at some point, yes, you can lose good faith if you, if you show, we're going to talk about this mass and Rock Hill case, which is exactly about all that.
Oh, okay.
It's a vendetta against in this case. But yeah, if you repeatedly show that you've got some personal agenda that goes beyond the board's agenda, yeah, at some point you're at risk. Yeah. So it's just the word in the law is designate. If you designate to a public official that something is confidential, and it truly is, and then they disclose it. Let's say that you're having a Walmart discussion. And they've been told that this is confidential. Look, people, this is confidential. This will be harmful. That is a violation of the ethics law. That is part of the duty of being a public official is not to disclose things that are confidential. So, how the heck do you do it? It's, first of all, yes, it is a very awkward point to come to when you've got a board member or some board members that you don't trust enough to do that. But sometimes it's necessary. Here's how you might do it. I've had districts, client districts that have had to do this, which is you're going in to talk about X, and it is something that, let's say it's a labor, bargaining issue. The information to be discussed in this executive session is confidential for one of the more of the following reasons. Now, it might be that you might be meeting with your attorney or have your attorney on the conference call. So you're telling all the board members, look, we're entitled to attorney-client privilege here, but if you walk out and you spill it to the media, we're going to blow the privilege, the value of this confidentiality is going to be lost. Don't do that. And second, category, information concerning a dispute that may be the subject of litigation, legal proceeding that would be harmful to disclose. Try to create a general category. There are all kinds of things like that that could come up. Information concerning a proposed negotiation or contractual agreement. You know, think about Walmart, think about the labor issues. The word disclosure would be adverse to the user. This sort of documents that you've told, you know, the board members have been, you know, advised that what you're talking about is confidential. Does that mean that board member, a board member could not walk down and talk? Yeah, they could. But at that point, if we were right about it, if it really was something properly confidential and they've been told that, at least we can say they have legally done something. And hopefully it reminds them of their duty to preserve. You know, hopefully it works. But that is a very long answer question. I always want to talk about that. Am I getting at what the issue is?
So what are the penalties for a ethic violation?
Mostly just a tremendous hassle for the person and they want to talk about what's going on with superintendents and Ethics Commission, it is a criminal. I mean, the ethics laws are criminal statutes. It's probably first degree misdemeanors. With Ethics Commission stuff, someone has to make a complaint. That's how it would happen, and. What people seem to be, you know, everything, I don't know, I've been around for a while, and it seems to me that the public are just getting so much more aware of things that they can do and have more access, I guess is the word I'm thinking of, to these channels. I work a lot with superintendents for the VASA organization. There's been a real flurry of complaints on superintendents and family members being employed in school districts that people perceive as being a problem, which may or may not have been a problem somewhere. I guess what I'm getting is people are getting the hang of the fact you can call the Ethics Commission purely confidential. And so people can go on the website, they can see something they think is wrong, and they initiate a complaint. There's a complaint, the Ethics Commission, what happens is they'll set up an investigation, which means they'll get the information they can first, and they just call you in for an interview. I've been through some of those, and try to make a determination whether it's something that should be referred for prosecution, that it should be. For a lot of things, a lot of these things, is we're having the superintendents and family members, where the way those are coming up, by the way, is naturally, I think we all kind of expect the superintendent's recommendation to be on everything that comes on the agenda, right? Every single thing. And when family members get hired, let's say an adult child graduates, comes to the home district, I think superintendents know that they shouldn't promote that, they shouldn't be involved in that. But what some people are missing is the problem of the recommendation itself. Even if it's a formality, even if it's like on a consent agenda, no matter how you do it, the Ethics Commission, that's a violation. because you as superintendent were recommending to the authority of your position that your son or daughter would say hired. What I kind of see is if the Ethics Commission, they're, first of all, in my experience, they are very straight shooters. They're really not on the witch hunt over there. If they don't see a real bad intent, you know, intent to manipulate, if the superintendent in this case really stayed away from the process, they will, they will probably do something like a public reprimand. It's a admonishment. They would not likely refer something to prosecution. That, you know, that's kind of the process and what would happen. But the board member who is kind of willing to go out and talk, you know, is this going to be, you know, inhibit that kind of person? Maybe not. It should, because it can be punished through the Ethics Commission. It's just harmful to the district. But anyway, my point is there is something you can do if people really are doing that on what they would. Any other questions around executive session? I know that's as board members, there are often many questions coming to us while we're on it. So we have all these questions. Is the presentation going on without me back there?
No, I just have to hit the...
Sorry. I don't care. So I guess, we have these codes of ethics that are, you know, you might say very aspirational, right? They're like the OSBA code of, you know, this is how it should be. It's good language, I think, to have in policy. But is that always what happens? I guess I'd ask you to look at a couple of things that go in the material. A resolution of censure, resolution of disapproval. This is another thing that's actually pretty rare to see occur. In 30 years working for school boards, there have only been a handful of times.
I would have to think your board would have to be pretty hot to actually sit there at a meeting and pass one of these.
That's exactly.
It wouldn't be 5-0 probably, huh?
That's exactly how it happens. You got to. That is so hard. That's such a hard thing for a board to do, and it's got to be something that really just made them mad. These are actual resolutions I've written. Both of these, I would say, one of them was fairly recent, one not so recent. It doesn't happen very often, but sometimes. Despite all these great aspirations and code of ethics, if board members always behave that way, no. If they did, you wouldn't see things like this. We talked about the penalty, you know, the Ethics Commission. What else can you do? Sometimes ask, what can you do? With the rest of the board, there's a huge frustration. Every once in a while, the rest of the board gets so mad that they won't. This one of, that uses the word censure, was exactly that confidentiality issue. And even some board members which tended to agree with this one board member were really upset this disclosure that took place and agreed to this entry. I mean, it was 4-1. guess, but it happens. So what can you can do, and the rest of the board, now sometimes you'll get a question, does the rest of the board have authority? Because, you know, you have the authority to censure, you know, him. I think the common law, this is pretty well adopted. Public bodies can censure members. Does it have an effect? It may or may not. But I think it can at least sort of declare to the community a disapproval of something that maybe the rest of the board wants to distance themselves from. The other one, the rest, which I don't know why the word of disapproval was used, I don't recall. But, okay, you kind of get the picture. Whereas board members intervening directly in administrative matters without criticism of the board, monopolizing the time of school administrators and numerous issues, making requests of teachers for confidential student information without parental permission, disclosing confidential information of students at their sessions of the board, which undermine the board, etc. Circumventing established security procedures. It's one of those things where you got a board member living in one building.
He thought I was a bad board member.
Yeah, that's right. This is to make you all feel better.
You only have about half of those, right?
There is not anyone in this room.
So can you take the next step and impeach?
What?
Can you take the next step and impeach?
Oh, yeah, that's a good thing. Impeach. There's not an impeachment. That would be fun to do something.
What's it called? No.
There's not. The board has no legal power.
I don't know. Some reasons.
Every board member is an elected public official. You know, the voters put them there. And there really is a limit. You can't put a gag on anybody. You can tell them that something's confidential. That's about as much as you can do. You can just sort of declare that you disapprove, but no, there's no procedure. The procedure is, I think, in the material. Oh, there it is. And sorry, this was a little bit random. There are a couple of statutes there.
It's a couple got to get enough signatures to take it.
Yes, exactly. That's what the procedure is. It's called removal for a board member. And that, too, is extremely rare. You know, we have about 5 years ago, 5 or 6 years ago, we had two of them within a year. We hired a member in Madison Plains that was on our news a lot. Okay? There's one that kind of not in the media market happening. And that time frame was in Rock Hill. And I'll talk about that in a second. But down in southern Ohio, had three members removed at the same time. And those of us, kind of the school lawyers, were just scratching our head. It's just, you just don't see it. And it happened quite. But anyway, yeah, that has to be initiated by the public. You got to get a lot of basic petition of 50% of the voters. Pretty bad stuff, you know. Someone who willfully, flagrantly exercises power they don't have, or willfully neglects to enforce the law. And then we go on, gross neglect of duty, gross immorality. Regular immorality is okay. Gross immorality, you kind of watch out for drunkenness, misdemeanors.
Does a DUI fall under drunkenness?
I don't think so.
Do you have to come to your board meeting, bro?
The DUI is not going to
One. Are you good with one?
This is a judge. Why are you asking?
He wants to know his boundaries.
Yeah.
I come to the morning. See where the box is.
I'm curious. Do you remember the one in Ashland where they wanted to go to the board for sunshine law? The board members were talking on emails about the superintendent calling in names, and the public tried to get signatures and have them removed for violation of sunshine law.
Where was that?
In Ashland.
Oh, Ashland? No, I
about 4 or 5 years ago. That seems to be the most common, is now that electronic communication is, you know, where people start talking in that kind of regard. That's you know, can become ethics, can become, and they were calling the superintendent by a different name. They kind of had like a code name for him that was not friendly, and kind of the paper into a public records request for all their emails and brought that out and stuff like that. So my board knows since I've been at 14, we don't email. That way.
We still have a code name for you, though.
Yeah. You can talk about that all you want out there.
The email is just going to talk about that. It's just killer,
But that's where I've seen it try to be applied, is that they try to get some certificate or judge for sunshine law violations. So that's
sunshine law is like the easiest way for anybody who doesn't like what you're doing to give you a kind of sunshine law, because if you look hard enough, you can always find something. You got to call the admin, make a records request for your email. It's email is you got to be really.
And the judge didn't find it gross; he just found it kind of unprofessional and unethical. But they weren't removed from.
I didn't actually. I didn't. The couple that. One was that Madison Plains thing, if you remember reading about that 7 years ago. Kind of just out of control in terms of just running roughshod over the superintendent, hiring some family members. Some family members that weren't even licensed properly. A lot of sunshine violation. Kind of this power. The both cases had this aspect of it where one board member was like given all the power, and they actually passed a resolution so whenever the board is not in session, this guy can do anything the board can do. And the court. Anyway, I looked at all this stuff and just said, this is really highly intentional and bad faith, and approved the removal.
Well, even if they pass a resolution, it's still not legally binding, is it?
No,
I mean, you have no authority outside of
it. No, it doesn't work. It doesn't, you know, that's it. They were just doing things that they're so out of bounds that they're just kind of creating processes that it doesn't really work. I know you're going to ask the board to do that to the next meeting.
Yeah, I was looking at it. If you had any wording on that resolution, that would be sweet.
To make you the czar. So.
Yeah, there you go.
Loretta Sites, Google Loretta Sites. This is Rock Hill in 2006. This one was like a true vendetta. So this board member came out, the superintendent. They're also a very strong personality. Didn't hire her son for a coaching job. Okay. And that's the start of the whole thing. She gets on the board. She does everything she can. She spends almost a couple $100,000 in legal fees, really without even the rest of the board. She gets multiple law firms to give opinions and get involved. Gets these opinions, won't show them to the rest of the board. They have meetings just randomly without the other board members present. I think it was a jury just looked at all this and said, yeah, those removed three board members. But that
that is, you know, that is one thing that can't happen. All these things are rarely done. The censure thing, and the removal, but I'm guessing we haven't seen the end of them. The public is just getting more aware and has more access and more ability to pursue these things. And with email, you know, the email, the records requests that you get for them, you'll see more of this thing. So, those are kind of bigger picture things. What I should convey to you during the course of this is, okay, now I'm going to try to give you kind of the legal framework. What are the laws that apply to you, and what are they, and what do they say? I have kind of two things that do this. Let me look at the outline here to just walk through this a little bit. There's the outline, and then there's a chart that I thought kind of simply presented three statutes. I know if you go to legal presentations, this is what lawyers will always do. They'll say, this statute says this, and this statute says this. I don't know how much of interest that is to you, so I don't try to dwell too much on that. But just to understand, basically, we've got three statutes that are kind of working all together. And I'm looking at the chart here at the moment. The 33.13.33. And Title 33 of the code is where all the school laws are, so we call it the school code. The school code statute. And this is probably really the strictest one. They'll say no member of the board shall have directly or indirectly, and that those words are really huge for them, because indirect can be so many more things than directly. You can't have directly or indirectly any pecuniary interest in any contract with the board or employee. Think of this one as the one that will really be in play when you have a business interest. You have a board member that is, has a business interest. You know, the classic thing would be like a musician, you know, hardware. These things are natural to occur for people who are involved in their community, to longtime business owners, to be on the board. The point is that to be on the board and have a business is very tough, in the sense that it's a very strict rule in terms of having any commercial involvement with the school. I almost would say it has to end if you want to be on the board. I mean, I think that's really how people are running for the board, you understand it. And I still see that isn't always quite understood. I think some of these traditions are so strong, like the music stores, for example. They're so close, work so closely with the schools, and might have been, you know, for 100 years, you know. And say we can't do that anymore. The school board member statute really wants to create total public confidence that nothing the board members do on this is. And so it's a really strict rule. So that's kind of that one. The 10203, that's what we just call the Ohio Ethics Law, the General Ethics Law, that think of that in terms of goodies, okay? That is the law that is kind of most in play when we're talking about, are you doing anything, using your position in any way, just to get something you wouldn't get, you know? And this is one where things have really changed, haven't they, in the last 15 years, in terms of just like people in the State House, and $100 dinners, and things that you used to be able to do when you went to school board's convention. Golf outings that you could go to. When I was a young lawyer, we had lots of golf events for school people. These things are out of bounds now, because those are things that we have a stricter standard now about those things. Think of that loss about that. We'll talk more about that. The one on the next page is the criminal statute. Title 29 is all criminal. That has to do, think of that one as family relationships. It's a lot of other things. But it really comes into play trying to get something for a family member or a business associate, some advantage. That's the one where that is forbidden. And it's trying to create a very, again, sense of trust in the public that public officials are not able to use their job to get family, particularly employment or benefits of any kind. This is the one that superintendents are getting tripped up on now, with the greater awareness of family members, even just a substitute employee or something. But somewhere on the agenda, they've been recommended, right, by the superintendent. That's a violation of that one. That is a fourth-degree felony.
So let me understand this. If our superintendent comes up and recommends...
Why is it you the one who has...
Just even for something as simple as... I got a friend. Even for like summer employment or anything like that, or we employ our students in the AV,
audiovisual.
Yeah.
For even a supplemental thing like that, nothing at all. You can't do that whatsoever.
No, you can't put your recommendation on any hiring. It's going to be what that.
I'm talking about the superintendent, not me. I'm talking about Diane. She's been trying to get a kid to do it.
Right.
The 3 weeks she's been here.
Yeah, she's 12.
Well, yeah, no, there are two things going on there. One is the superintendent who would recommend it, and that's like part A. That's one thing, okay? Like your summer job, my daughter's going to mow the grass or something. It seems innocent enough. The other thing... That's going to be one of these things. It was just a few years ago that this commission said for a minor employment of a minor for a board member's son or daughter, that is a problem because not because you recommended it, but because you have an interest in the earnings. Because any minor, by law, you own their earnings as a parent. Maybe that'll help you.
My minors are all grown up.
Wouldn't the board just abstain from that vote, or would that get them out of that? Or is...
Yeah, that's a good question. If you're a board member, could you abstain from that, but the superintendent?
Good question. That's a very good question. No, abstaining doesn't help. The way it's written is you just cannot have an interest. And that's actually in both of those. Now, as I said, A4, I didn't bold that part. A4 is no public official shall knowingly do any of the following. Just have an interest. It's not, number one is authorized, and recommend any cause. And
so what about your spouse?
Your spouse? You can abstain on that. The spouse's earnings are not presumed to be.
Even though you might be filing common marriage.
Yeah, I know. You know, the ethics laws, when they're interpreted, they seem to kind of almost give a pass on a lot of the spouse stuff. They take a softer line with some of that. But as you know, lots of spouses get employed in the school districts, and that you can stay in there. The problem, I guess, if you try to analyze it the way the ethics commission is, with a minor, it's automatic that you have this right as a parent, so their earnings, they consider that kind of an automatic. A spouse, their earnings are their money legally. Now, usually you co-mingle that in real life, but if you abstain on that, you haven't used your position to get it, you can still get it.
So I'm sorry, can you just clarify that question just a little bit more? So
yeah.
It's a minor, and the board happens to approve it, and let's say it's my 14-year-old, we're going to give him a supplemental to the AD department,
yeah.
And I abstain from it just because I think, well, I have to abstain from it, but the board goes ahead and approves it. Who committed the felony at that point?
Yeah.
Was it the superintendent, or was the board, or was it
that's
the...
That's right, if you didn't vote on it. It's kind of almost seems unfair, and you didn't vote on it. Maybe you were out of town when they voted. You know what I mean?
I know, but who's liable at that point? Because it's still a problem,
it's
right?
Still, as a public official, technically, you have an interest in a contract of the board. The awkward thing is, it's the rest of the board that created the contract. You know,
right?
But technically. Now,
the ethics violation could be found all.
That's not really what I'm asking. Yeah. Really,
so whoever's going to turn it in, the person who makes the phone call is going to say, you know,
ethics commission.
Jeff put pressure on the superintendent, and then the homeowner was followed along, or whatever, you know. And so all of you could be, it's whoever, however they want to investigate from there to the phone call is going to blame all five of you.
Okay, next question.
Is there
a statute of limitations?
I don't disagree. That seems unfair. What was that?
Is there a statute of limitations?
I don't know what it is.
We can look.
No one's calling you, you're okay so far.
You have a friend who needs to know that.
I do have another question about the where you talked about the superintendent makes the recommendation. What if, you know, you have a director of IT or a director of whatever that makes, you know, requests that this person be hired? Is the superintendent really getting off, or is he kind of still the one who's making that recommendation because it's on the agenda? You know what I'm saying? So if the director of IT hires somebody, and it has to end up on the agenda for the board to approve.
It's if it's on the agenda, I mean, the ethics commission will be very formalistic about that. If on the agenda, the superintendent recommended that. That's a problem. That's technically...
Okay. What if just in the board meeting, Kimball, Doug just... makes a motion to do it and gets a second and get three and you get five people to vote yes on it, and it was never on the agenda. It was just, I make a motion that we're going to hire this person.
Well, here's the thing. You got...
I hope you're not going to do that.
That's how they do it in the fairway.
Yeah, that's all we do in the fairway. We have no relationship.
Whatever
we want to do.
Yeah. It's just sort of improv.
Right.
Yeah. What I was going to say is, I hope I answered your question. There's a problem with the superintendent recommended. With a non... One thing to point out, I guess, in all this is the difference between classified employees and licensed employees. To hire someone like a teacher or an administrator, the problem is... that state law requires superintendent recommendation. Superintendent is like a gatekeeper. I mean, if they don't have your recommendation, they cannot hire person X in any way, shape, or form, which is an important role for a superintendent. Classified people, there's actually no wording in the law about recommendation at all. So if you can really avoid it, let's say it was a tech job that a kid was going to be hiring, the superintendent should just stay out of it. And one thing in the materials is that vice counsel mm-hmm. article. It's in there. Anybody seen the advice of counsel?
Yes, I have.
Hold it up, yes. I can't even find it. I know you're mainly board members here, and that isn't your issue, but that's where that just went out to all superintendents, an article I wrote about that issue of recommendations. And one thing it will point out there is that on the classified side, not in my teaching side, this is pretty easy to avoid. I know it's very automatic to want a superintendent on every item on the agenda, but that's easy to avoid. The awkwardness is with the superintendent. I'm talking to somebody this week about this. Superintendent himself, near retirement, his daughter's just graduated, wants to teach in the home district, and there's been a committee, you know, to screen, and superintendent stayed out of it entirely. Clearly the strongest candidate. But we have this problem, which is that for her to be hired in that district, the law says the superintendent must recommend, right? So it's like a standoff. How do you deal with that? I wouldn't say there's an easy workaround, depending on whether the person might have worked for the district before, which happened in her case. The law says that a board can reemploy somebody without the superintendent's recommendation to get a 3/4 vote. In this particular case, the daughter had subbed, I think, on some basis before. So arguably, the board now has, because she was employed previously, the board can reemploy her. The superintendent that has been reprimanded by the commission for sub job. It's sort of like, I think he's paid his dues on that. I think the board now can reemploy her by 3/4 vote without her. Again, that's probably not a board member issue as such, but it could be an issue in your district. And it kind of shows the problem here of making recommendations and hopefully make you aware of how that is viewed by the commission. I forget what the original question was.
I just had a comment. One time at Capitol Conference, I attended an ethics work breakout session, and they had a member of the ethics commission there, and she was there in an unofficial capacity. And I could not believe some of the questions mostly board members were asking. I mean, stuff that would just knock your socks off. But she talked about the law and specifically referenced certain situations, but she said something very interesting, and that is that even though you might meet the letter of the law, that oftentimes what is perceived as being done is almost as important as meeting that letter of the law, and that is just what you mentioned. There's ways to get around that, but if the public perceives that all they're doing is just getting around it, or there's more to the story, there has to be, and the way things work in small communities, before you know it, the perception and the loss of trust with the board is almost more damaging than what you may not be meeting with the letter of the law.
Yeah, they talk about the appearance of impropriety, and that's huge. I mean, for the public, you've got to pass levies and have support to do anything. It's almost more important, you know, than anything else. I agree totally. I think think with a lot of these family situations, the public actually, well, the public kind of does make up their own mind. I think, you know, we have the daughter who comes out. I think people understand that. And unless they know that that's been manipulated or there's something. But there's a huge sensitivity out there to have any family, you know, any family relationships. There can be times with the recommendation where it actually is a legal problem. And for some reason, this is coming up a lot more now. The law really hasn't changed. I think it's just awareness, access to information. It's what we see, so, yeah.
So why is there a statute with no penalty?
Which one is that?
33.
No criminal penalty? Yeah, it's true. There isn't for that statute. What it does is it makes the contract invalid. So it's sort of the purpose of the law is to create confidence in the public and to prevent contracts with that have where a board member has a benefit. It's not. Yeah, it's a little different. It's not focused on punishing the employees. It's a good point. It's just a different. The ethics bits that this statute is the punishment type statute. The outline, because we talked about it, those are the three. Anyway, the purpose of that chart was kind of there's three things that work there. They kind of do different things. Just a sense of what each is about. The outline does this too. I won't belabor this here, but you know, there's an overview source of law there on page 3 that is kind of trying to do the same thing. Where these laws come from, what each one does. I think.
Can I just ask one question?
Yeah, sure.
If I were coming down to your office to hire you on to do some work for us, and you said, hey, let's go out to Starbucks, is it an ethics violation for you to buy me a cup of coffee while we're talking? I would assume that it is, but I don't know if there's a... I mean, I don't think you should do it anyways, but is there some kind of limit on that? Not that I want free coffee, but I'm saying, I mean, I think we've all tried to avoid any
like every minute or whatever.
Exactly. I meant the dollar amount. I mean, is there a dollar amount that really you get a 25, no, it's less than $25?
That's the number one question, yeah, is, you know, the 10203, the goodies part of this. Yeah, are you in any way getting some? The Ethics Commission has this language of, maybe we can use this here. Let's see. Yeah, on page 5 there are gifts. You can't accept anything of value that sort of legalese here. Substantial influence, and substantial and improper influence. They'll never put a dollar figure on it. They never want to do that. But I can tell you it's somewhere in the $20, you know. It's sort of, we call it the Bob Evans rule, you know. If I took you to Bob Evans and you got the special, you know, you can be okay. They use words of, could almost do a whole presentation on all the Ethics Commission rulings about meals and things. They talk about meals of an ordinary and routine character. A cup of coffee is not going to be, you know, that they're not concerned about that. What they really are concerned is it's like the conventions going to Maxwell's Steakhouse. And that was done not that long ago, you know that. But it's hard to say where that is, but I'm trying to
It's
no, and I think you should avoid it. I mean, even a cup of coffee. I was just kind of curious if you accidentally, you know, like I came to meet with you and you already had my coffee sitting on the table because you know I like mine with cream, no sugar. Yeah. But you know what I mean? I mean, at that point, but I mean, at that point, you know, I would have to pay, I mean, I would insist on paying for it, but maybe, you know, if I forget about it or.
You know, I'll tell you what I do under the current regime. If we were out somewhere at a restaurant, I'd just say I would not pay for anything was yours because there's a beer having bill, and I just say I'm sorry, you know, you just don't do that. It's just, you know, I think most people get that. When you come to our firm and we have a meeting and we have like a lunch tray with, you know, cold cuts, what I call ordinary hospitality, we do that, and okay. we don't. As much as we worry about, you know, these things, we work. If that gives you a sense, you know, don't.
Yeah, I guess that's a good question. If I go to your office and you know, you have steaks there for us, that, you know.
Yeah, well, we don't. We used to. Bricker used to do, and some people, you know, at the Capitol Conference, a reception.
Yeah.
Like in the firm building, it was like shrimp, you know. And then that was stopped because of the golf ruling. So we're just at a point where I think it's easier, as you say, for everybody just say nothing and like it, except, you know, a cup of coffee, you come, we'll have a box lunch if you come with me. And I can tell you from talking to Ethics Commission folks, they're not interested. They've got Cuyahoga County to worry about. They're really not. The only thing I was trying to do with this is to say the kinds of things these laws are. Those were the laws. Now, what are the kinds of things they get at? I think you have a general sense of this anyway. Number one, it's abuse of your influence. Using your position for a personal benefit, trying to get something for a family member or business associate. That's one thing. Two is the goodies, okay? The gifts, the things, the gifts, or they don't have to be a gift, just anything that's an advantage or benefit. It's not a nominal amount, but a really small thing. Is pretty strictly used these days, particularly from vendors. So I'll talk about that in a minute. Supplemental compensation we haven't really talked about, but that's another law that it's kind of the thou shalt not have two masters law. And the concept is that public servants should be for the work that they do should get their money from only one source, which is public employer. Classic example of a booster's football coach takes the team to the state championship. People want to do things for the coach, or they want to just help with the coach. I mean, a lot of you don't have money to have coaches at all. Boosters want to. Can't do that. You can't do that directly because then they're really beholden to that source, right? That's right.
I hate to pop in another question, but I want to ask you. If I have an agenda item on there that says assistant football coach paid for by the boosters, and this board approves it, is that?
That should not be. Yeah, there was an ethics opinion on this just a couple of years ago on coaches. And I had a number somewhere, but if you want, but trying to address this very common situation they're seeing, which is particularly since schools are running out of money, you know, play, where boosters were for paying. And pretty innocent. I mean, that's what boosters want. But the Ethics Commission had to come in and say, look, there's a law, it's always been there, it's says that it's a public servant, your only source to be. And so what the Ethics Commission says is there's no problem with the boosters donating money to the district as long as the district genuinely has the decision what to do with it. If the boosters say, it may be perfectly expected that it would be used. But if the board is, you just can't have them really controlling that decision.
So how would you control that donation? So if our volleyball booster said, hey, here's, $5,000 for a coach or whatever, how do we note, how does our treasurer note that so that, we want to make sure that we, hopefully that we would be able to use it for that, but we want to make sure we're still within the guidelines of the ethics.
Yeah, I think the commission is going to let you take that donation, even with the expressed desires and acknowledge that, what we can do, and in your language and so forth, you want to avoid that they gave this for the coach, and so that's what we have to use it for.
So would it be better to accept a donation from the volleyball boosters to support the volleyball program, and at that point we could just use it to
right.
pay for a coach?
Put them right next to it.
Yeah, I think you're get away with that.
Well, I'm not trying to get away with it. I just want to make sure we're with
that. I didn't mean anything by that. Except it gets very gray, doesn't it?
The
coach is going to know where the money's coming from either way. I think you just have to, and it's a formality, the donation has to go to the board, first of all. You can't have the boosters paying the coach directly.
Well, that's for sure. I get that.
But I think you just want to, in the way you describe it, not reflect that it is.
Strictly for a specified purpose?
Unless
it's to buy equipment, though, right? Or is that different as well? Can they donate $1,000 to buy volleyballs?
Problem. No, it's just the employment. The employee can't have the sense that they're being paid. Now, in the real world, they're going to know where the money's coming from. But the commission, I think, was trying to write a fairly soft opinion on it, just saying, look, you just can't do it directly that way. They go on to say it's okay to make a donation to the district. Now, it doesn't say how to do that for the athletic program or the volleyball program. That's where I'm not sure how finely they shave that. But,
so what is the district's responsibility or due diligence if, you hire an individual as a volunteer? And done what you think, and then you get catch wind that boosters pay. Boosters are a separate entity. We don't handle their books. Now they have their own tax identification number. What kind of investigation does the district have to do in order to protect itself? Or any, what all? You understand my question?
Yeah, I never thought of a volunteer.
It's here in another district.
That's right. We're talking about, we've heard from other places.
A friend of yours in another district.
It's Ashland. All right, that's a good question. Yeah. I mean, how do you know that? Yeah.
And then how do you go about proving it?
We don't necessarily know because have proof, but.
I think you just have to say, someone has suggested that this is occurring, people need to be reminded that that's not permitted, that the person is a public servant, even though they're volunteering, that if they're going to be compensated for that, it has to be funded.
It's really an ethics violation of the coach's compromise if they have a teaching certificate. I mean, if they're strictly a volunteer in the community with no license, but if they have a license, they can be turned into the ethics commission and have that full for accepting money, accepting compensation outside of their job.
And for a licensed person, then you get into all the conduct that we have. I mean,
most of your volunteers aren't going to have licenses.
They don't even have to have a law.
That's a good.
Not if there's just volunteers that aren't going to be alone with the
I think the main thing is you can endorse that are allowed to have
people for which is what we do. If you're a volunteer, you still have to get that.
It's an OD.
It's true. We require everybody to have that.
So I hope I'm answering. I think you just have to take a position that can't be tolerated. And if it's occurring, it shouldn't occur. And,
the proof is still.
But I don't know if you have a duty to conduct an investigation. I mean, it's just, it is the person's violation. This ethical violation. So I guess that's when you make the anonymous statute. You're a volunteer. I guess that's what you do. Have we finished with the coaches? Like coaches, you know, always. There's one other aspect I'll mention, the confidentiality we talked about. Conflicting positions, that is another ethics. Ethics. I suppose it's conflict of interest issue. It goes under the heading of compatibility of public offices. Can I be a board member and a county commissioner? Can a person be a teacher and have some of the public job? Sometimes it's viewed, the attorney general rules on these, and they look at the jobs and they see, do they conflict? Does one inhibit the other? Does one control the other? There are just certain public jobs that you have to look at and see if they're compatible. And I won't go into that a lot, except that there's go on attorney general has historically done those rulings, and there's long lists of jobs that are compatible and incompatible. Sometimes you run into that issue. So just wanted to mention that. Why don't we talk about some of these examples? Okay. Here we go. Should I have a clicker?
Raise your hand. Just raise your hand when you want to click. Okay. Right?
These are some of the, just thought I'd run through some comments. And I'll do my best with these. Okay, any problems with a board member spouse being in the bargaining unit? Generally, that's going to be okay. I think what the commission's going to say is that you can't do anything really that's just specific to your spouse. To get your spouse a specific benefit. It's probably trickiest with superintendents that have to, you know, once the spouse is in the bargaining unit, maybe they were there before you became superintendent, the board can renew them without a recommendation. That looks pretty rare. You get four votes. But you got to watch out for the other things, like just approving, let's say the spouse applies for tuition reimbursement, you know. Simple thing, like they apply for sick, but, you know, it sounds like, how could this be a problem? But the superintendent might routinely be the approver of those benefits. You need to get somebody else to do those. But anyway, as a general matter, that's not per se a problem. The opinions we'll talk about, collective bargaining, it can become an issue. If the spouse is on the bargaining team, then I think maybe you need to abstain from voting on it.
So if they're not part of the bargaining team, it would be okay for all members to vote on that?
Yeah. It's involvement on the team, and you can get an issue where spouses are on the teams. They will start to view that as a thought, a direct interest.
There is that.
But aside from those things, no, generally, you can, you know, that's going to be okay.
All right. The board member themselves cannot be in the board's bargaining.
I think a board member could be on the bargaining team. I think you'd have to, I think there's a problem if the issue is going to benefit the spouse directly. But I don't know that that's prohibited. I'm a little fuzzy on the question. I'm not thinking that's an issue. Unless the spouse is on the team, then I think we can know that's an issue. The health care, yeah, there's that whole aspect. If you're getting health care through the spouse, there's been a pretty lenient ruling on that. One of the things I want to point out here, before we leave here, and I do want to talk about a few more of these ones. One of the best things I thought I could give you is this summary. I've done it for years and keep it up. These are school-related ethics training rules. Just a real quick summary. And if anyone can find this question in there, you can raise your hand and share with the group. I want to come back to these, but
it looks like it's at 89.05. Next to the last one.
Board member okay to vote unless spouse and officer are on the negotiating team. Yeah. 89.005. The spouse was in the bargaining unit. And it also had the complication that the board member was a teacher and an OEA in another district. So two things going on there. So it's okay to vote on an agreement unless the spouse was on the team, then you should abstain. The OEA membership, you couldn't be on the board team if you were a teacher in another district. In the OEA, and you're bargaining with the OEA. That's under the collective bargaining law.
Now, is this just restricted to spouses? What if my daughter were a teacher and it was in the bargaining unit?
I think there's one on that one. Let's go back to the third page there. I think it's 98.03. That's a superintendent, but superintendent is okay to negotiate, deal with collective bargaining issues. Again, if the daughter were the president or on the bargaining team, then that's viewed as too direct an interest in her contract. But without that, it's okay. But you can't, again, if it says you can't be approving things for the daughter. Benefits for the daughter. But there's nothing wrong per se with having the adult child in the bargaining unit. You just have to work a way to avoid approving specific benefits for them. And of course, we have that problem we talked about when they're first hired. How do you get them hired if they weren't already there in the bargaining unit? But no, children could be, it's kind of fairly common, as you know. Not per se. Lots of questions here. Let's just kind of buzz through these, because some of these are here, and then I want to draw out a few more, and I'll consider my work done. Here's the answer. I didn't know my answers were in
here. Surprise for everyone.
The board member spouse is in the unit. The board member can vote. They can vote. Question: any problems with board member spouse? I mean, yeah, that someone was just pointing that we were just looking at that. Not a problem with the spouse in the unit unless they're on the team. But if you're a teacher, say an OEA member, working in another district and you're negotiating with the OEA, I think common sense tells you, collective bargaining law says you can't, you couldn't be a board member on your team. Okay, what's the board we got for the next one? What if the board member's spouse is a teacher and the board member gets health benefits through the spouse's insurance? Go ahead to the next one. Since the answers are here, which, yeah, it's we have actually two. I added this. Both the Ethics Commission and the Attorney General took a look at that too and kind of surprised me a little bit and said that that's okay. You can vote on the agreement, and even though you're getting health benefits through that agreement, to me, that seemed like an indirect benefit for the board member, but AG, for what it's worth, gave us a pass on that. So the way things stand right now, not a problem if you're getting coverage through. Yeah, a board member has, for example, a music store you can sell to. And the answer is you can't sell, absolutely, yeah, sell to the district. Now, I say absolutely, there are these exceptions. The paragraph C exceptions are kind of, some things are viewed as necessities or staples or commodities that truly can't be gotten cheaper elsewhere. I mean, there's sort of a common sense exception to things you can't reasonably get other places. Or there's a common course, prior course of dealing, and you can't get them cheaper. There is a common sense that you might be able to do this thing. But the basic rule is, you know, musical instruments, I think that's going to be tough to meet that exception because you can go on the internet and buy musical instruments. And sell the boosters if the boosters purchase for donations to the district. I think the commission is still seeing the interest working now through the boosters. They're saying, no, you can rent instruments to parents. Here's the key, and this, you know, forget the music, any kind of business, using, trying to somehow use your position to get in front of parents or get more business, that can be a subtle thing, but that would be a violation to use your position. Obviously, it's okay to donate things to the district, but they don't want to. You advertise. See, the point is that if you have a music store, you don't have to. It's just, you know, next slide. You know, we talked about this one too. Summer lifeguard. Go to the kid to the answer. There's pin 93.
Nope.
No, because with a minor, even though maybe the rest of the board voted, maybe you weren't even there, but the board created a contract now that you have legally this interest in, and that is that's technically a violation.
That's both the board and the superintendent, right?
Yeah, if the superintendent recommended that.
No, I mean, superintendent or superintendent's job. You can't recommend your own.
Because the superintendent cannot just have an interest, that's true too.
Right, I mean, because if it's a minor, then the problem. Superintendent can't recommend that.
Can't recommend it, or really even not.
But if they're not it, not a minor, what if they're already?
They're still a family member.
Well,
if you're no longer a revival of the law,
if they're 18, then it's not your money. You don't legally have an interest as long as you don't recommend. And you don't have to.
Okay, they're not licensed.
For non-licensed, you wouldn't have to. That can happen. Can a board member be hired by the district? Sometimes that happens. Somebody sitting on the board sees a job, you know, in the district they might be interested in. That's not uncommon at all. Ethics Commission looks at this, and all I would tell you is they're just very strict about, yes, you can, but you really have to very carefully avoid, while you're still on the board, doing anything to make it happen, to lobby anybody. You really just want to avoid talking about it. You really need to resign before you apply. In the real world, that can be hard to pull off perfectly. But I wanted to point out there at the top that there's also, though, a per se exclusion if it's a job that was created while you were on board. You can't for you.
So if I'm a board member and I authorize we have a new aluminum can picker upper, and that's 9 months before I get off the board. 3 months after I'm off the board, I can apply for that job, right? Because it's a year. Isn't that what that says?
For 1 year. I think it's 1 year after you get off.
Well, I'm just asking because that says after we authorize it. So we created that job 9 months before I got off the board. 3 months after that, it would be the year after we authorize that position. Is that?
No, I think it's a year after the...
I thought so, but the way I read that, it didn't seem quite right.
Yeah, I don't know if I have the exact wording around here. I'm thinking that otherwise you could just, you know, try to get a position created for yourself and wait a year. I don't know. I'd be glad to check that for you.
I was just curious the way that...
Do you want cream?
No sugar, though, right?
This job aluminum can.
An aluminum can picker up. It's very important in our
business. Pays very well.
I think it's a year after we come along. It's like a revolving door. Okay. Let's see. Are there any more?
Yes. No.
Yeah, gift or travel from vendors. Yeah, go to the insert. No. And then classroom, no. Again, I would say here, the rule on this is very strict. It's almost too strict. As stated here, the very bottom of the first page on these summaries, it would seem to make sense that maybe your district's going to get a certain kind of stadium turf or a cafeteria dishwashing system. You know, it really kind of makes sense that you might go want to see that. But the Ethics Commission is so strict about vendors plying people that they even apply that to just travel expenses. In other words, they view paying your airline ticket to go see this thing, even if you're Southwest Airlines, that's viewed as like a benefit. That's viewed as something of value to you. It seems like a stretch, but it is. I just emphasize how strict that rule is, because it's an easy one for your folks to get into to pay to go see something. It seems to make sense. It seems innocent. But the rules are very, very strict on that. So, and it's, as I say, it doesn't matter if you could have competitively bid it. It doesn't matter if all they're doing is paying the travel. And it doesn't matter if, they're giving the money to the district, to reimburse you. That doesn't help either.
Kimball, a lot of times in schools, photography companies will come in and take student pictures, and many times there is a residual kickback to the district. But I don't know how else to say it.
I think this is
pretty common practice. My question to you is, that hearing this, it makes me concerned.
It's not except for that individual, though. It usually goes into an O18 account.
Right.
So the principal expends it to the entire district.
Right.
It's never a problem if the money's going to the district. It's all this is about individual gain in some way. And if the district can enter into a school picture agreement that can generate some revenue, that's really okay.
Okay.
The problem
as long as it doesn't go to the principal.
Yeah, they want to get free pictures to him or the teacher who is organizing
it. Right,
that's it. Okay.
Go on.
Next one is school free trips, same sort of theme. Some of these things that were really customary, you know, been doing this as a teacher, maybe yourself, organizing things. Yeah, the tour operators, no freebies of things. There's some, 2000 opinion. You can see all these opinions by the Ohio Ethics Commission website. They're all there to read. Tour operators. Employees can come and be chaperones, and it's okay that they're getting travel and food and accommodation, as long as that's part of the contract, you know, the deal that the district is buying. It's a way of providing those services. And yes, you're being paid in that way, but that's okay. That's part of the contract. Spouses, it's kind of odd, you know. Naturally, spouses, chaperones often come in pairs like that, but because they're not employees receiving something as a form of compensation from the district, now you're getting a benefit for a family member through your status. So anyway, those are some rules on that. That if you have this situation, that's a good one for you. Is there another one? How many?
So the boosters pay for it, or the board's not liable?
If the boosters are paying.
Right, we had our band boosters pay for a band for. Mm-hmm. Chaperones and whatnot. I don't think the board, other than saying go for it, have a whole lot to do financially with it.
Those weren't. So it was an off. It was an approved trip, but it wasn't really in school. It was all just donated by boosters. Mm-hmm. It's not striking.
Contract for the trip is with the school district contract for the trip too.
They made all okay. They were just kind of thing. So well, yeah. I mean, they're a private organization, a nonprofit, they're an unincorporated association, whatever they are. if that's just part of a big charitable contribution they're making in terms of contracting for the travel and giving that to kids. I'm not seeing the problem.
I know the former district I was in actually took the opposite side because the teachers or whoever were receiving the benefit of going. So the contract had to reflect, just like what you said, had to reflect the number of chaperones. But their spouses, who traditionally had gone for free, could not go for free.
Well, there are lots of issues there, that go beyond what's just legal, things the way you want it to work. Discounts, okay for employees to accept. It's as long as they're for a large kind of group, like maybe a Target in town, school employees get 10% off, but that kind of thing's fine. Obviously, it's when discounts are being given to some public employee for something specific they're doing. Generally not a violation. It was uniformly applied. And go to the next slide. The exception would be, okay, so all discounts are okay, and the answer is, no, actually, they looked at, again, they're going to look at each one. Policemen, in this city, they're going to get a discount. It's like from these retailers, because police provide security for these businesses. That's part of their job. That's getting too close to the comfort of the city, but that's kind of like paying them for doing their job. So it depends. Frequent flyer miles, kind of a quirky thing. Can do you keep them or not? That was a real big question for a while there, and the commission looked at that and said that's actually, when you think about it, it's a discount that the airline is giving. That should be employer's discount. So basically, no, those are not to be used by you. That is something you would be additional compensation for you, and really not your property in a sense. But no frequent flyer mile. And we talked about, yeah, daughter in the bargaining unit. Is that going to be a problem for any adult child, son or daughter? Generally, okay to negotiate. This is a superintendent we're talking about. Advise, etc. Yeah, as long as the daughter's not an officer, then you start to have a direct interest in she is more directly interested in regarding the issue. You can deal with the bargaining unit and general issues. But you might get an issue where it's getting a close question, like maybe the daughter is a special ed teacher or some kind of teacher in some unit that we're talking about a benefit for maybe a very small group of teachers. That's getting pretty close. It's something that the superintendent wants to stay away from. You get into small groups of teachers. Golf outing, any problem? That was kind of really your basic question. Yeah, what is the dog? You know, things that you get from somebody trying to do business. A lot of the verbiage around that is meals of an ordinary or routine character, things like that. Certainly Bob Evans standard. And that's as close as they will come. Sometimes you'll get the ethics commissions out talking, you know, and they'll give you, the former director put a number on it a few times to speak in the groups, but it's always seems to be in the $20-$25 range before their antenna really went up. I wouldn't push that. Yeah, we talked about this. To see those things, the answer's going to be no. It really has very strict rules about that. Watch out for that. You know, we keep seeing this, and it's not because of your folks. The vendors just often still don't get this. They may work in different states with different standards. Just a few months ago, it was what kind of thing? It wasn't a real product vendor. I think it was educational. They did things like educational training or curricula of some kind. They wanted to fly some people to a conference. The conference may not even involve their product, but it seems very innocent, but this is someone who is seeking to sell something to the district, trying to now provide travel to a conference. Can't do that. A reception. This was such a hot issue with the CAP conference and things several years ago. And I guess we're kind of covering our tracks here again. This is the conference setting, and this is sort of almost more directed at Bricker and Ackley. You know, you're putting on a reception of some kind. What are the parameters on that? 2002, which is the same ordinary routine character of a meal. The event is educational or informational. It has to be open to everybody. So you're not trying to, get a benefit to some particular customer or some of the public official. Okay. All right. We'll leave it at that. Yeah. I think we've covered, this list, I think in our discussion we just ended up talking about all these, just recommending tuition waivers. That one's kind of new, kind of surprised some people. I'm sure my wife did this. She's a teacher and supervised student teachers. A typical thing is a high state might get tuition waiver. You know, when you do that, that seems innocent enough. That was found to be this problem of the teacher getting extra pay from somewhere out there for something that was really sort of his or her regular job. Supervising a teacher done during regular work time, getting a benefit, so it's the outside compensation. So if OSU needs to give that money to the district, not directly to the teacher. I'll let you, I think we've covered, I guess there's all those things they wanted to, but anything that's left unanswered?
And don't forget. And I like turkey on white on my box.
One in everywhere. Well, I hope there's something useful there for you. Nice to meet you. And if you have any follow up on this, I'd be happy to track down some nice things that might come to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We got stuff.
Okay. Thanks, Marysville.
Thank you very much for inviting us. It was great.
Oh, thanks for coming up. It was kind of cool.
Actually, I think we're going to adjourn. We have to resolve all of our business. All right, I need a motion to adjourn.
Second.
Move in second. Roll call, please. Move second.
Yeah,
I moved. And Tracy second. Mrs. Devine.
Yes.
Mrs. Greer. Mr. Yeah. Mamie.
Yes.
Mrs. Powers. Yeah. Mr. Lassiter.
Yes.
Okay, we are adjourned.